from Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
According to court documents today, Scooter Libby said that the president authorized the vice president to direct him to disclose classified information to reporters in order to bolster support for the war in Iraq.
Leaker in chief, did President Bush authorize highly classified intelligence to the media? We'll speak with investigative reporter Murray Wass, then veteran war correspondent Robert Fisk.
You've only got to look at the New York Times or the LA Times on an average day and count how many stories begin or end with the words American officials say, American intelligence officials say, always sourced to anonymous American officials, officials, officials. LA Times is particularly bad on this. I can even give an example. But over and over again, I think your newspapers should be called American officials say and just drop the words New York Times at the top.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Vice President Dick Cheney's former chief of staff has testified President Bush authorized him to leak a highly classified intelligence document on Iraq to the press in an effort to defend the administration's decision to go to war. This marks the first time President Bush has been linked to the leaking of classified information and raises new questions if Bush was directly tied to the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. Lewis Scooter Libby's grand jury testimony was cited in court papers filed by prosecutors late Wednesday. Libby was indicted in October on charges he lied to investigators about his role in the outing of Plame, the wife of former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who was a vocal critic of the war. In 2003, President Bush warned against anyone in his administration leaking classified information.
Let me just say something about leaks in Washington. There are too many leaks of classified information in Washington. There's leaks at the executive branch. There's leaks in the legislative branch. There's just too many leaks. And if there's a leak out of my administration, I want to know who it is. If the person has violated law, the person will be taken care of. And so I welcome the investigation. I'm absolutely confident that the Justice Department will do a very good job. There's a special division of career Justice Department officials who are tasked with doing this kind of work. They have done this kind of work before in Washington this year. I have told our administration, people in my administration, to be fully cooperative. I want to know the truth. And if anybody's got any information inside our administration or outside our administration, it'd be helpful if they came forward with the information so we can find out whether or not these allegations are true and get on about the business.
President Bush speaking on September 30th, 2003. On Capitol Hill, Bush was widely criticized by Democrats Thursday. This is Senator Charles Schumer of New York.
At the very least, President Bush and Vice President Cheney should fully inform the American people of any role in allowing classified information to be leaked. Did they believe they had the right to do this? And if so, in what circumstances? Or is this just something that may have been done to accommodate the president's momentary political needs? According to court documents today, Scooter Libby said that the president authorized the vice president to direct him to disclose classified information to reporters in order to bolster support for the war in Iraq.
New York Senator Charles Schumer. In other news from Capitol Hill, the Senate failed last night to agree on passing what had been described as the most far-reaching changes to the nation's immigration laws in two decades. During the day Thursday, a bipartisan group of senators announced they'd reached a deal that would put millions of undocumented immigrants on a path to citizenship and to establish a guest worker program. But after a long night of debate, no vote was taken, and it now appears a vote might be put off until after the Senate's Easter break. Meanwhile, in Los Angeles, Cardinal Roger Mahoney held a special mass as a sign of solidarity with undocumented immigrants. Mahoney has vowed to order priests to ignore a proposed law that would make it a crime for priests, social workers, health care workers to help undocumented workers.
Well, we're at a very critical moment, I think, in the history of our country with immigration, and we have the opportunity now that we haven't had in many years to actually have a law that is humane and just and deals with all the issues around immigration.
Dolores Huerta, co-founder of the United Farm Workers, also spoke in Los Angeles.
This is really great right now. We're seeing a new civil rights movement being formed by Latinos. The Cardinal having mass and such good support because this is such a national organization. When the Cardinal says he's going to commit civil disobedience on behalf of the immigrants, then this is going to inspire others to do the same. This will have an effect on Washington.
Across the country, immigrant groups are planning for massive nationwide protests on Monday. Back in Washington, the Bush administration is now suggesting it might have the legal authority to conduct surveillance on domestic communication between Americans without a court warrant. Until now, the administration has maintained it only has the authority to conduct warrantless eavesdropping of calls made to or coming from other countries. On Thursday, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez testified before the House Judiciary Committee. When he was asked if the president might order strictly domestic spy operations, Gonzalez said, quote, "I'm not going to rule it out." Congressmember Adam Schiff of California said he found Gonzalez's statement to be very disturbing. Schiff said, quote, "If the administration believes it can tap purely domestic phone calls between Americans without court approval, there's no limit to executive power. This is contrary to settled law and the most basic constitutional principles of the separation of powers," he said. Meanwhile, a retired AT&T telecommunications technician named Mark Klein has reportedly given a sworn statement that AT&T has been working with the National Security Agency to spy on Americans. Klein gave this statement as part of a lawsuit by the Electronic Frontier Foundation against several major telecommunications companies. Klein reportedly also disclosed several internal AT&T documents that showed AT&T put a dragnet surveillance in place to help the NSA. Klein's statement and the documents have been put under seal. According to attorneys at Electronic Frontier Foundation, the leaked AT&T document supports the group's claim that AT&T is diverting internet traffic into the hands of the NSA wholesale in violation of federal wiretapping laws and the Fourth Amendment. EFF staff attorney Kurt Upsal said, quote, "Mark Klein is a true American hero. He's bravely come forward with information critical for proving AT&T's involvement with the government's invasive surveillance program." Meanwhile, Democratic Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa has admitted in a radio interview that he's embarrassed that more Democrats have not supported Russ Feingold's motion to censure the president for illegally ordering the NSA to conduct domestic spying.
"The Democrats don't have the guts to stand up to censure a president who misled us, who lied to the American people, and who broke the law and violated the Constitution of the United States in spying on American people." Now, I tell you, we've got to give some more backbone to a lot of Democrats. We need to hear from people.
That was Democratic Senator Harkin appearing on the Bill Press Show. In health news, a congressional report has concluded the Bush administration's international AIDS prevention programs are being hampered by requirements that force recipients to spend significant amounts on abstinence education. According to the Government Accountability Office, AIDS specialists in 17 of the 20 countries surveyed said the Bush administration's requirements, quote, would prevent them from allocating prevention resources in accordance with local HIV AIDS prevention needs. In order to qualify for U.S. assistance, seven countries had to allocate one-third of their prevention funding on abstinence education, forcing cuts to several essential programs. In news from Haiti, a top United Nations official is accusing the U.S.-backed interim government of illegally detaining most of the 4,000 people behind bars in the country. The official said most of the detainees should be released immediately, including the hundreds that are being held for political reasons. More than 2,000 people are now jailed at Haiti's national penitentiary. Only 4% of the prisoners there have been sentenced. In news on Iraq, the Washington Post is reporting the Bush administration is dramatically reducing spending on so-called democracy promotion in Iraq. The move has angered several Republican-linked organizations who were awarded contracts after the U.S.-led invasion. U.S. officials said the money was needed to pay for increasing security costs. Les Campbell, who heads Middle East programs for the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs, said the president's commitment to democracy in Iraq, quote, when it's translated into action, it looks very tiny. In Peru, a retired army officer who once tried to overthrow the Fujimori government has surged into the lead in this weekend's presidential race. Ollanta Humala has received widespread support among the nation's poor and has been endorsed by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. But Humala has been widely criticized by business leaders. He's called for the nationalization of Peru's natural resources, new taxes on foreign mining companies, a veto on a trade agreement with Washington, and an end to U.S.-sponsored eradication of coca. Humala spoke on Thursday before supporters.
El pueblo peruano está inmune.
The Peruvian people are immune to that fear of change. The Peruvian people want change. We don't want more poverty, more social injustice, more unemployment, more abandonment, more corruption. Tonight, the Peruvian people should confirm their desire for change. A new society, that is nationalism.
Peruvian presidential candidate Ollanta Humala. On Capitol Hill, Democratic Congressmember Cynthia McKinney has apologized for being involved in an altercation last week after a Capitol police officer failed to recognize her as she tried to enter the building. McKinney said, quote, I'm sorry this misunderstanding happened at all, and I regret its escalation. I apologize. There should not have been any physical contact in this incident, she said. A grand jury is investigating whether McKinney hit the police officer. She'd maintained she has been racially profiled. In media news, about 20 staffers at the Village Voice have written a letter of protest over the firing of investigative reporter Jim Ridgway. Ridgway has written for the paper for 30 years. He was fired just months after The Voice was bought out by New Times Media, a chain of weekly newspapers based in Phoenix. The Voice staffers wrote the firing, quote, sends a terrible message as to the sort of coverage that the new ownership portends. Major changes have already been seen at the paper since February 1st, when the new owner of the paper, Mike Lacy, first traveled to New York to meet with Voice staffers. After that initial meeting, The Voice's prize-winning press critic, Sidney Schamberg, quit. Veteran columnist Nat Hentoff reportedly also resigned and then reconsidered. According to one account of the meeting, the new owner criticized the news section of The Voice because it was full of commentary and criticism of the Bush administration. That same week, the new owners canceled The Voice's online blog called The Bush Beat. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Louis Scooter Libby, the vice president's former chief of staff, has testified that President Bush authorized him to leak details of a highly classified intelligence assessment to the press to defend the Bush administration's decision to go to war with Iraq. The news has created a firestorm in Washington. Throughout his presidency, Bush has often denounced leaks from his administration and vowed to punish the leakers. The top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, Congressmember Jane Harman of California, said, quote, if the disclosure is true, it's breathtaking. The president is revealed as the leaker in chief, she said. Libby's grand jury testimony was cited in court papers filed by prosecutors late Wednesday. Libby was indicted in October on charges he lied to investigators about his role in the outing of former CIA operative Valerie Plame, the wife of former Ambassador Joseph Wilson. In July 2003, Wilson published an op-ed piece in the New York Times questioning the accuracy of Bush's claim that Iraq had sought nuclear materials from Niger. According to Libby's testimony, Vice President Dick Cheney told Libby to divulge to the media portions of a national intelligence estimate regarding Saddam Hussein's alleged efforts to develop nuclear weapons to contradict Wilson's claims. Libby says he refused to do so because the NIA was classified. A little later on, Cheney told Libby that he'd gone to Bush and that Bush had specifically authorized leaking the information in the NIA. According to the court papers, Libby testified such presidential authorization to disclose classified information was, quote, unique in his recollection. Libby also testified that an administration lawyer told him that by authorizing the disclosure, Bush had in effect declassified the information. That authorization led to a July 8, 2003 conversation between Libby and then New York Times reporter Judith Miller. The filing said Libby understood he was to tell Miller that a key judgment of the intelligence estimate was that Iraq was, quote, vigorously trying to procure uranium. According to the New York Times, the CIA did not believe this finding, which came from Defense Intelligence Agency and remains unproved to this day. Prosecutors have alleged in the case against Libby that at that meeting, he also gave information to Miller about the identity of Valerie Plame. But the court filing makes no allegation that President Bush or Dick Cheney authorized the disclosure of Plame's identity. However, the papers do place the president for the first time directly in a chain of events that led to Plame's outing. For more on the latest, we are joined on the phone right now from Washington, D.C., by veteran investigative journalist Murray Wass, who has broken story after story on the saga of the outing of Valerie Plame. Murray Wass maintains a blog at whateveralreadyblogspot.com. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you with us. Why don't you go through exactly what you learned from these documents that were filed by the prosecutor on Wednesday?
What the prosecutor said, and he's, for the most part, in the court paper, simply re-reporting what Scooter Libby has said in his grand jury testimony. Grand jury testimony being kept secret by the grand jury rules, but allowed to be made public during different events in pretrial. Libby essentially said that the President of the United States and the Vice President authorized him on occasion to leak classified information, not just to make the case to go to war, but when Joe Wilson first went public with his allegations, to then defend how they made the case to go to war. And so there were documents and things that they thought were exculpatory that helped their case, that showed that they didn't think they did anything wrong. So the president and vice president simply said, if this helps our cause, you can make this public. We can declassify this. We'll do this unilaterally. We'll do this without telling anybody. We'll do this without going through the formal process. And they did that. And in the meantime, and what I think is missing from the press coverage, not because anyone's trying to conceal it or anything, but just because it's kind of a nuance, that the direct opposite of that is that the administration is able to keep secrets and classify things that they don't want out that are politically embarrassing, that are going to hurt them. In this case, things that were going to hurt them from getting reelected. And they've had these extraordinary leak investigations using the powers of the state grand jury, the Justice Department, and such, to an extent that hasn't been used since probably the Nixon administration and Watergate. So on the one hand, they're tightening the amount of information that can get out. Anything that's going to hurt them, they can keep that classified. And on the other hand, they've radically changed the system in that they can put out anything they like. So you get pretty much a one, you get a version of events, which is what the government or what the administration wants to tell you, which is just harmful to democracy. And what I think we're seeing is, and it has nothing to do with Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, right-wing, left-wing. You don't want to give an administration, you don't want to give a government that power. You don't want to allow them to become a sovereign when it comes to the dissemination of information, because information is essential to a democracy. And can I veer off on a tangent? Because it's not much of a tangent, but
go ahead.
Something that facilitates this. We have the, these kind of almost unprecedented powers and generations being afforded an administration to control the flow of information. In the meantime, the free and independent press is just dissipating into a press that's compliant, sensational, commercial, just not doing its job. And we have, cumulatively, you look at little, you know, episodes or whatever. But when you're doing your news cast before, I mean, the Village Voice, for example, it's a paper that I work for a little bit in my wayward youth. To have Cindy Schamberg, who's one of the great, great, you know, foreign correspondents, former columnist for The Times, and now past 70, you know, an extraordinary press critic, so much so that he won one of the nation's top awards for press criticism after doing everything else in his career, you know, leaving that paper. You know, and Jim Ridgway, who's been kind of a steady anchor there for more than 30 years. You know, someone whose politics and column I don't always agree with, but you know, someone who always went out of his way to, you know, be kind to me and other people and encourage good journalism. So it Village Voice might just be one paper, but you see, you know, Knight Ridder, you see the bureaus of major papers in D.C., you know, a third, a half what they used to be. And so the powers of journalism are getting down to the level of almost a crisis, I think, for democracy. And you combine that with the government being given, or the Bush administration taking unprecedented radical new powers, you're allowing the government to, you know, take, it's just bad for democracy.
And Murray Watts, let me ask you something. Back on these leaks, you point out in your piece that although not reflected in the court papers, two senior government officials said in interviews with the National Journal, who you write for, in recent days, that Libby has also asserted Cheney authorized him to leak classified information to a number of journalists during the run-up to the invasion. In some instances, the information leaked was directly discussed with the vice president, while in other instances, Libby believed he had broad authority to release information that would make the case to go to war. So this is going way back.
Yeah, I mean, we see two different strands here. One is the case to go to war, how he went to war. And then secondly, after the war, after the cessation of hostilities, at least as the president has said, the administration then had to defend how it made its case to go to war, whether it had been truthful, whether it had adequately, you know, represented what the intelligence agencies of this country said, whether it allowed the free flow of information. So there were really two efforts. To go to war and then to defend what happened after war. And the defense, people kind of forget the time frame. In July 2003, when Joe Wilson made his allegations, and this came to the forefront, George Bush was trying to get reelected. And 2004 was a major year, not only for Bush, but the Republican Party because of the House and Senate races. But going back, Scooter Libby, he was one of the people who went out on behalf of the president and met with Judith Miller, Bob Woodward, reporters like this, and was authorized to give them classified information, nuggets of information that supported not so much their viewpoint, but what they thought was evidence, or in a lot of cases, purported evidence or phony evidence to make the case to go to war. And
you also say that Libby testified that he also spoke to David Addington, then counsel to the vice president, whom Libby considered to be an expert in national security law, and Addington opined that presidential authorization to publicly disclose a document amounted to a declassification of the document. Of course, Addington has replaced Scooter Libby now. What about the significance of this, that once the president says release it, it's really no longer leaking it because the president is automatically declassifying it?
Well, I think what you're seeing is what David Addington's saying is the president is a sovereign, and we've seen throughout history, throughout American history, the legislative branch and the press and the public saying no, that's not the case. But wartime presidents assume more power. And we have to think how important, how central information is. In other words, when people might be more upset that David Addington writes a memo saying the president in wartime can torture, he can detain people, he can go beyond the Constitution, he can allow the NSC to wiretap without court authorization. But when he's making this statement about information, it's just as important, because without information, without a show like, you know, for example, it's just not a show like yours being able to be on the air that's freedom of the press. It's also you need the information. You know, you need information to flow. You need people in government to talk to you. But every journalist, including me, you know, even Seymour Hersh, we're all building on the work of other journalists and what else is out there.
Murray Wass, finally, what is the significance of this right now? If the president is the, what some were saying yesterday, the leaker in chief, so what?
Well, it just gives the president of the United States this extraordinary power. If he wants to go to war, information that would undercut what he's saying publicly, critics who disagree with him, information in the bureaucracy.
Is it illegal?
Well, apparently.
Could he be indicted?
It's interesting. Apparently you can't be indicted. The president, under his constitutional authority, gives him the right to declassify information. But it doesn't, what we've seen, and we've seen very mainstream and conservative critics of this, say if the president does it and it's within his constitutional prerogative or it's within the law, it doesn't make it right. It doesn't mean that it's good for the democratic process.
And does this change the story that we've been covering, the whole story of the outing of Valerie Plame? Where does it go from here? And what more do you expect? You've had a lot of inside sources on this story.
Well, the most important thing, of course, is the trial of Scooter Libby, which is held off till 2007, and the strategy
after the election, the 2006
correct,
election.
Correct, correct. And the question is, again, I think at the core of this is a president, is he a sovereign when it comes to the government's information? Is he the person who can eke it out? Now, interestingly, that's the issue that brought Scooter Libby to the grand jury and has caused his indictment. But now what we can see is the Libby has asked for classified information to be used at his trial. And Pat Fitzgerald has said that that's graymail. It's an attempt to just ask for classified information for no other purpose to try and shut down the trial because the government won't want to declassify it. Well, it's not Pat Fitzgerald, though. It's not the prosecutor or the people or the grand jury who get to decide whether the trial goes forward and information will be declassified. It's the intelligence agencies and government agencies, the CIA, for example. It's the Bush administration's Justice Department, and it's the Bush administration. So we could potentially see the shutdown of the trial because, again, the president is almost a sovereign when it comes to information. The check on that is Congress. The check on that is the press. The check on that is programs like your own and what the public says about that. But this is what, for those of your listeners who are old enough in Iran-Contra, it was the same type of thing where Oliver North and a number of other defendants, charge after charge, were thrown out as a backdoor way to end the investigation. So, again, you're giving the executive branch, through this issue, what they can classify and declassify, these extraordinary, extraordinary powers. And so you can, if the indictment is correct and Scooter Libby is prosecuted, and he does deserve the presumption of innocence, but if he did do what the indictment says and he is ultimately convicted, you're still giving the executive branch the classification powers.
Murray, we're going to have to leave it there.
Sure.
But I want to thank you very much for being with us. Murray Wass, veteran investigative journalist who writes for a number of publications, has been breaking a lot of these stories in the National Journal. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
At the end of the early British wars, a young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men a lying, I saw many more a dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I march to the battles of the
Phil Oakes singing I Ain't Marching Anymore. Sunday marks the 30th anniversary of his death. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Iraq, is the media telling the real story? That was the question asked at a public debate sponsored by Reuters this week in New York. The panel included journalists from the New York Times, the International Herald Tribune, the Wall Street Journal, and Al Hayat. Also on the panel was Lieutenant Colonel Steve Boylan, who recently returned to the United States after 16 months in Iraq as chief spokesperson for the military. I attended the event and had the chance to question Boylan. This is an excerpt.
How many Iraqi civilians do you believe have been killed?
I have no idea. I really did. There are so many conflicting reports depending on who you listen to. I'm not sure even the Iraqi government knows to date.
President Bush said at least 30,000. The Lancet said an estimate based on a Johns Hopkins Columbia University study said over 100,000. I'd like to get your comment and the other journalists on this, and then two other quick questions.
Let's make it one question.
One is about fake news about the U.S. military continuing to use groups like the Lincoln Group and the Pentagon itself planting stories, paying Iraqi journalists to print stories. And the third is we talked about journalists killed by insurgents, but what about journalists killed by and detained by the U.S. military? Specifically, we had David Schlesinger debating you, Lieutenant Colonel Boylan, when the Reuters cameraman Hadem was wounded and detained. Walid Khaled, the Reuters soundman, was killed. The Al Jazeera reporters who were held at Abu Ghraib for months, Ahmed Mohammed Hussein and Salem Uraibi, and then released with no explanation, detained again and released with no explanation. Jose Coso with Palestine.
I think we get the message, Amy. Steve?
That's a lot. Based on my understanding right now, there are no journalists being detained in Iraq right now. Journalists may, whether they are stringers or any other journalist for that matter. The situation in Iraq is not like you will find it in New York or Chicago or Miami or London or any other place. It is a war zone. They are held, they are not arrested, which is a misperception by a lot of people. They are a security detainee because at the time of the event, there was something that was going on that at least appeared to be a security risk to the Iraqi forces, the Iraqi government, the coalition troops under the UN Security Resolution 1546. There is a process in place to investigate what happened, investigate the individuals, but there is not the same jurisprudence that you would think that is happening in the United States. It's not the United States. It's not Europe. The same rules do not apply. And until everybody understands that, there will always be the issue of unlawful detention from some people. I believe, like I said, that from what I understand today, there are no more journalists or stringers or anyone else that's worked for the news media that's being detained.
That was Lieutenant Colonel Steve Boylan, the former chief military spokesperson in Iraq. We're joined by Robert Fisk, chief Middle East correspondent of the London Independent. For the last 30 years, he's been covering almost every major event in the Middle East, from the civil wars in Algeria and Lebanon to the Iranian Revolution and the Iran-Iraq War, from the massacres of Sabra and Shatila to the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, from the 91 Persian Gulf War to the invasion and ongoing occupation of Iraq. Robert Fisk has just finished his latest book. It's called The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East, and joins us in our Firehouse studio here in New York. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Do you know Lieutenant Colonel Boylan?
I've seen him in performance, yes, live.
Your response?
Look, these guys live in the green zone, the little area of the former Republican palace, which is a bit like living inside, I'm sorry to say, a Crusader castle. You can look between the palisade and see a bit of the street outside. And they are totally divorced from the reality of Iraq. I mean, Boylan says, for example, oh, I don't think even the Iraqis know how many Iraqis are dead. Bush didn't say, by the way, at least 30,000. He said 30,000 more or less. He would not have said, oh, there are 2,000 American dead, more or less, would he? He wouldn't have dared to say that. But he could say it because they were Iraqis. I think the Iraqis have a very clear idea how many there are dead, because when I went in August to the main mortuary, the mortuary officials in Baghdad showed me the Ministry of Health computer, which I'm not allowed to see, which showed 1,100 Iraqis dead in Baghdad alone in just July. So they have the figures. That's not a truthful statement by Boylan.
At the event, this debate put on by Reuters, Lieutenant Colonel Steve Boylan, the former chief military spokesperson in Iraq, was also questioned about the military's use of the so-called information operations. This was his explanation.
What is information operations? What first comes to mind? I would submit that most would automatically think of deceit and probably more in the lines of psychological operations. It's interesting that information operations is still trying to be figured out within the military and definitely within the public and the media on what it really means and what are all it encompasses. There is no information operations campaign against the American public or to the American public or in the American public. And this kind of goes back to the question about paying Iraqi newspapers for stories to be printed. Well, to the best of my knowledge, all the stories are true. They did focus on the more and if the positive aspects of what was happening.
Good news.
Well, the good. Yeah, I don't want to use the term good news. Progress. See, I still won't use it. Because the, if you want to call it, the adversity was being covered extremely well. When that story broke, I was just leaving Iraq. I can argue either side of the story on that one, for or against, because if that's the only way you can get the other side of the coin to be published, then why not? Many people call it advertising if it wasn't being done by the military.
What about
propaganda is propaganda true or false?
But I mean, one of
propaganda is part of war.
I mean, one of the things that you know the U.S. government were always pointing out is the kind of the vibrant Iraqi press. How do you expect the Iraqis now in the streets to believe any good, positive story that is genuinely written by Iraqi journalists? See, I'm not dismissing the act of good stories, but the problem is when there is such a kind of like this grave thing that's happening now in Iraq, how can you, and such a politicized way, how do you expect journalists, Iraqi journalists, decent Iraqi journalists, to go into the streets and write a positive story? Everyone would be pointing at them, said, oh, you've been paid by the kind of Pentagon, the American army, and all these things. So yes, you maybe managed to get like some positive stories, but you inflicted such damage on the young Iraqi press. I don't see how they will recover from it. It's a deja vu from the days of Saddam. Yes, Saddam was, we can argue, he was trying to do the same thing, was trying to put advertisement in the press.
Well, my understanding also, which I don't think has been widely reported, and I wish I had some statistics to give you, most of the stories that were, quote, paid for never got published.
You win some, you lose some.
Yeah. Exactly. That's
a good story.
Yeah, well. the paying for stories doesn't happen only, and I'm not going to say it, I've been in other countries where their own host country governments, businesses pay journalists to cover what they're doing. I'm not saying it's an accepted practice. I know there's a lot of focus on it right now with the Lincoln Group and the military's participation in that. But it all goes back down to a lot of it is some of the startup publications that were in Iraq, they could not have started without some assistance because it does take money, it takes equipment, it takes people, other resources to run a newspaper.
Lieutenant Colonel Steve Boylan, the former chief military spokesperson in Iraq, also responding to my question about the so-called information operations or the planting of stories that the Pentagon has done in the Iraqi press was freelance Iraqi journalist Haith Abdul Ahad. We'll get response from Robert Fisk, veteran war correspondent, in a minute. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. For our television listeners, we just showed the Reuters display that appeared in Times Square just a few weeks ago, the names of journalists who've been killed in Iraq. Their stories were enlightening, and their work will not be forgotten. Their stories will not be forgotten. I'm Amy Goodman. Robert Fisk is our guest. War correspondent for more than 30 years. Your response, once again, to the issue of the planting of stories.
Well, I'm surprised the military have to plant stories because I find that an awful lot of my colleagues are quite happy to go along with stories planted or otherwise. You've only got to see the number of times on the front page of the New York Times or the LA Times or the Washington Post when the phrase American officials say appears, particularly the LA Times. I can give an example of that, in which a whole story is repeatedly sourced after 2003, when we know there weren't any weapons of mass destruction, when we know the press was misled totally in the United States and went along with the war party. Still, we see everything being sourced and resourced back to American officials as if the U.S. administration is the center of world truth. I give you an example. I was actually doing the book tour in Los Angeles, picked up my morning LA Times. Here's a story about Zarqawi, who may or may not exist, of course. U.S. authorities say, U.S. officials said one Justice Department counterterrorism official, U.S. authorities say, officials said, U.S. officials said. It turns to page B10. It gets worse and worse. Look. Several U.S. officials said, those officials said, U.S. officials confirmed, stop me when you want. American officials complained, U.S. officials stressed, U.S. authorities believe, said one senior U.S. intelligence official, U.S. officials said, Jordanian officials said, Amy, see, we've got a slight difference here. Several U.S. officials said, U.S. officials said, U.S. officials say, U.S. officials said, the American officials said, one U.S. counterterrorism official said. Welcome to American Journalism Today on Iraq. This is what's wrong.
How would you write the story?
I wouldn't write that for a start because I don't believe this particular story, which is claiming that Zarqawi has better intelligence than the United States. He doesn't. It's just that the United States military doesn't know how to use intelligence because it doesn't understand what the war is about. But anyway, also, I'm not sure that Zarqawi is alive, and this story claims that he is, and he's the mastermind. This is supposed to be the Al-Qaeda mastermind.
What indicates to you that he isn't? The latest story we have, the possibility...
he's been killed?
That he has been forced to step down.
So oh, yes, Iraqi according to American forward. Officials, I remember this story came out, yeah. Look, Zarqawi has not been seen by anyone other than U.S. officials, say, ever since the beginning of the war. I think it's possible, and many Iraqis think this, that he was killed in one of the initial air raids on Iraq in the northeastern area, in the Kurdish area, and that his ID has somehow come to be used by some other institution. He has a wife of whom he was very possessive, who is now so poor in the town of Zarqa, she has to go out to work. When his mother died more than a year ago, he didn't even send condolences to the family, or so the family have informed me.
And the family lives in
Zarqa, hence his name Zarqawi, of course, in Jordan. But, you know, the problem is that if this man believes he's a true Muslim, why didn't he send sorrowful greetings to his family on the death of his mother? Very, very weird. And over again, we hear American military officials say, oh, they think they can identify him in a videotape. This is a guy wearing a hood, right? I don't know, maybe he is alive, or maybe he's a creation. But I've never met anyone who's met him recently in Iraq, which surprises me because I do meet a lot of people in Iraq.
Robert Fisk, the latest news out of Baghdad, a suicide bomber inside a Shiite mosque in Baghdad and another outside blew themselves up, killing at least 40 people today. The blast also wounded 45 people. The mosque in northern Baghdad belonged to Skiri, the most powerful party inside Iraq's ruling Shiite alliance.
Somebody wants a civil war in Iraq. I don't think the Iraqis do. You know, we have this story again. It's a sort of the narrative that's been laid down that all the Sunnis are rushing around blowing up Shiite mosques and all the Shiites are burning down Sunni mosques. And that's not the Sunnis and the Shiites I've met in Iraq. We keep hearing about people being kidnapped by men wearing police uniform or police stations being taken over by men wearing army uniform. Well, do you mean to tell me there's a warehouse in Fallujah with 8,000 police uniforms made to measure for insurgents? I don't believe it. I think the policemen are real policemen. I think the men wearing army uniforms are real soldiers. I think that the military on the Iraqi side has been thoroughly infiltrated by the insurgency. And I think there are death squads operating on behalf of government ministries. We know the Interior Ministry has a death squad. And that's some of those corpses that I see in the mortuaries, including women, blindfolded, hands tied behind their back, shot in the head. These are not being gunned down by insurgents on the roadways or blown up by bombs. They're victims of death squads.
I wanted to ask you about what is happening in Israel and Palestine, the Hamas elections, latest news. European Commission has temporarily halted direct aid payments.
They voted for the wrong people, Amy. They voted for the wrong people. They misused democracy, you see. This is what happened in Algeria, isn't it, in 1990. The people were given democracy. They voted for the feast, so the military cancelled the second round of elections. We didn't want democracy to begin with in Iraq. Then we worried the Iraqi Shiites would join in the insurgency. So we had democracy, and we've got an Islamic government in Iraq as well. Believe me, it is Islamic. It is effectively an Iranian government, because Skiri and Dawa, the two main linchpins of the government, they grew up, they were the creation of Iran. In Lebanon, we've now got democratically elected a Hezbollah minister in the cabinet, whom the Americans can't talk to, of course, because, again, they elected the wrong people. We've got this problem in the West Bank. There's a story here somewhere. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood get 88 seats in the Egyptian Assembly elections. We've got Hamas in power. We've got an Islamic government still in Iran, of course. What's going to happen if Syria disappeared or the Syrian government went? You know, at some point, we're all going to have to face up to the fact that if people do have a genuinely democratic election, we've got to talk to the people they elect, not the people they elect, if they're the people we want them to elect. And that's the big problem for us in the Middle East at the moment.
What do you think is going to happen with the Hamas government?
Look, the Hamas government will talk to the Israelis, and they probably already are. I remember when the Hamas officials, who were all in those days, quote, terrorists, unquote, were thrown out of Israel into southern Lebanon. And I was talking to them on this hillside. Most of them, or some of them, have been blown up since by the Israelis, of course. And I remember I was saying to these guys, you know, well, actually, I'm going to be going to Israel tomorrow via Cyprus or via Jordan. I can't remember which way I went from Lebanon. And one of these guys, Hamas people, bounded down the hill and said, ah, Mr. Robert, you might like Shimon Peres's home telephone number. And it was Shimon Peres's home telephone number because, of course, these people all talk to each other. I remember after the Oslo Agreement being in Jerusalem and discovering, and it was on the front page next day of the Jerusalem Post, that the Israeli army had actually sat down and been negotiating with Hamas officials after the Oslo Agreement on the White House lawn, the famous shaking of hands between Rabin and Arafat. So these contacts have continued between Hamas and the Israelis. This business, oh, we don't talk to terrorists. This is for children and journalists.
Your most recent piece, Another Brick in the Wall, you say we've been conned again. The Israeli elections, we're told, mean that the dream of greater Israel has finally been abandoned. West Bank settlements will be closed down just as the Jewish colonies were uprooted in Gaza last year. The Zionist claim to all of biblical Israel has withered away.
Well, this is my point that it's not correct. What's happened is that the wall, which we prefer to call a security barrier or fence, see your New York Times, it has taken away 10% of the 22% of Mandate Palestine was left to negotiate over for the Palestinians. The Jordan Valley has gone. The roads that run like concrete ribbons across the territory, which is the so-called viable Palestinian state to come, are not going to be moved. And the major Jewish settlements or colonies, which is what they would, colon in French, at least they use the right words in the French press, are going to remain. Mali Adumim, this vast concrete semicircle which divides East Jerusalem or what was Arab East Jerusalem off from the West Bank, that effectively, along with the wall, and it is a wall as tall, if not taller, than the Berlin Wall or the Berlin Fence, as we would have called it if built by the Israelis, this effectively means there is not going to be a Palestinian state. So the idea that Mr. Olmert is going to suddenly invent new frontiers and we're all going to accept it, it's pie in the sky. I can't see how the UN can accept a new frontier. I can't see how the EU can. I can't see how even our own dear Mr. Blair is going to accept that. I'm sure Mr. Bush will manage a way there.
I wanted to get your comment on Noam Chomsky talking about troop withdrawal in Iraq. Noam Chomsky, the world-renowned linguist and political analyst.
There's a certain principle that we should adhere to. The principle is that invading armies have no rights whatsoever. They have responsibilities. The prime responsibility is to heed the will of the victims and to pay massive reparations to the victims for the crimes they've committed. In this case, the crimes go back through the sanctions, which were a monstrous crime, through the support for Saddam Hussein, right through his worst atrocities, but particularly those of the invasion. Those are the two responsibilities of a occupying army. Well, you know, the population has made it pretty clear. Even U.S. and British polls make that clear. Overwhelming majorities want the U.S. to set a timetable of withdrawal and adhere to it. Britain and the United States refuse. Reparations we can't even talk about. That's so far from consciousness in the doctrinal system. Well, I think that answers the question. It doesn't really matter what I think. What matters is what Iraqis think. And I think we know that pretty well. The reason the U.S. and Britain aren't withdrawing are those I mentioned. You know, the consequences of independence for Iraq would be an ultimate nightmare for them, and they're going to try to do anything they can to prevent Iraqi democracy as they've been trying in the past.
And the argument that they will just descend into civil war and that the sectarian violence will increase, and the U.S. went in and now has a responsibility not to leave a mess.
Yeah, I mean, the Germans could have given the same argument in occupied Europe, the Russians in the satellites, the Japanese in Asia, and so on. Yeah, they could have all given the same argument. Well, we went in, now we have a responsibility to ensure that terrible things don't happen, and so on. And the argument had some validity. So when the Germans were driven out of France, let's say, yeah, there were thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people killed as collaborators. And in Asia, even more so. But is that an argument for them? No, it's none of their business. We don't know what will happen. And it's not our decision to make. It's the decision of the victims to make, not our decision. Occupying armies have no right to make we could have an academic seminar about it in which we could discuss the likely consequences. But the point is, it's not for us to say.
Robert Fisk, do you agree with Noam Chomsky?
I always like to agree with Uncle Noam, as I call him to his face. Yeah, it's a pity we weren't having this discussion before we invaded Iraq and that we've waited till now before we get round to discussing our responsibilities. I remember at the very beginning of the press conference series when our friend Mr. Boylan was talking a lot, when we were told, oh, you know, we know that some Iraqis' innocents have been killed, we're trying to find out how many. And I remember I made a point, hold on a second, you know, you are the occupying power. You have, and this is very much what Noam said, you have a duty, you have an absolute responsibility, even under the new UN Security Council resolution, to protect these people and to care about them. And the idea of protecting and caring about Iraqis simply wasn't there, because we didn't go to look after Iraqis. That was not the reason why we invaded Iraq. And why did we invade Iraq? Well, if the national export was asparagus, as I've said before, I don't think the 82nd Airborne would be in Mosul.
So what has to happen now?
They've got to get out. We've got to get out quickly. Our presence, and you only have to go and be in Iraq to see this, our presence is fueling the violence there. We are the petrol burning on the surface. And we've got to get out. How we get out, you know, I've said this to you before in this program, you know, we must leave, we will leave, and we can't leave, because we've got to find some political hodgepodge to try and pass off on us, the people, as to why Mr. Blair and Mr. Bush are pulling out. But pull out we've got to do, and quickly, and we're not wanted, even by the Kurds now, it seems.
And the same question to Chomsky was, what about the idea that the country descends into civil war?
Well, I said just now, somebody wants it to descend to civil war, but I don't, you know, I've told this story before. I went to the funeral of a doctor, Sunni Muslim, sat next to his brother at the funeral feast afterwards and said to him, is there going to be civil war? And he said, we're not a sectarian society. We're tribal. I'm married to a Shiite. Do you want me to kill my wife? And in many cases in Iraq, and most of the people I know, most of them, and maybe by chance, are actually mixed marriages between Shiites and Sunnis. And I don't think they're trying to kill each other in their mixed marriages. I think that what is happening is that there are certain forces which are going after the idea of civil war and trying to provoke the Shiites into retaliating, because somebody wants the Shiites fighting as well. Because if you have the Shiites and the Sunnis both involved in armed violence, then that's the end of new Iraq, isn't it?
Who wants?
You know, if I could give you the answer to that story, it will be on the front page of my newspaper tomorrow morning, Amy, and I don't know the answer. And it's very difficult to say, look, I don't think it's this. I think it's something else without telling you what the other is. I don't believe that men in police uniforms are insurgents dressed up. I think they are policemen. I believe that soldiers in military uniform are soldiers. This is exactly what happened in Algeria when they used to have what they called faux barrage, false checkpoints. And we'd say, oh, all these Algerians line up at this checkpoint manned by men in police uniforms who then cut their throats after 6 p.m. And it quickly turned out that these were guys who were policemen during the day and at some point, like 6:05, became something else. But they were the same guys.
You don't come to the United States very much.
I come an awful lot, actually, on average, every 3.5 weeks. But I don't always go on your program every 3.5 weeks, Amy.
Well, when you see the networks, what do you think?
Oh, I try not to see them, and I try not to read the New York Times, and I definitely will not be reading the L.A. Times anymore. You have a major problem in the United States in that your journalists don't challenge authority. They will not challenge authority unless they think authority is lying on the ground. Then they'll go and have a timid kick at it, which we're now seeing with the Scooter Libby affair. But by and large,
And with Katrina, yes.
But by and large, you only have to look at a presidential press conference and Mr. President. Yes, Amy. Yes, Bob. Yes, John. That's how the relationship, osmotic, parasitic, fearful that to be questioning of power will suggest that you are unpatriotic and thus potentially subversive.
Robert Fisk, I want to thank you for joining us. He'll be speaking tonight in New York at the Ethical Culture Society with David Barsamian at 7 o'clock and tomorrow at the CUNY Grad Center at 34th and 5th at 4 p.m. And Democracy Now! Is headed to New Orleans. Tonight we'll be in Baton Rouge, and I'll be speaking at the Campbell Auditorium and the Cox Communications Academic Center at LSU, Louisiana State University. And tomorrow we'll be doing a benefit for WTUL, Tulane University, at McAllister Auditorium at 5 p.m. We'll be broadcasting from New Orleans on Monday. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Kaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Frank Lopez, and Jenny Hughes. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Special thanks to Danielle Stramberg-Peshkin and Megan Whitney. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.